Dave and DAB Digital Radio. It's time for the daily service now, led by Father Phil Sumner. On FM, we continue our book of the week. Michael Pennington reads from Philip Larkin, Life, Art and Love by James Booth. As librarian at Hull University, Larkin has overseen the building of a new library. He continues his relationships with both Monica Jones and Maeve Brennan, unable to commit to either. His literary reputation is established and he's busier than ever.
In the mid-1960s, a large shift was taking place in Philip Larkin's life. Public and professional activities came to the fore, and his poetry retreated into a more private space. He agreed to serve on the board of the Poetry Book Society, and in April 1964 he was elected a Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature. He was instrumental in setting up an Arts Council Manuscripts Committee to acquire the papers of living British poets for the National Collection. And in May he gave his weight to the programme by donating his first workbook to the British Library. He was to act as committee chairman for 12 years. In 1965, he was awarded the Queen's Gold Medal for poetry. Larkin bought his first car on the day that his new volume of poetry, The Whitsun Weddings, was published. He wrote to Monica Jones, "I feel I ought to go out and see that I've locked the boot and that no one can steal my jack, spare tyre, etc. Oh dear, isn't it all untypical? I feel as if I'd somehow slipped through into a different character." In letters to his mother Eva, casual references to his new status are mixed with the trivialities of his domestic life. Some days after her 79th birthday, he sent her a card relating how he had driven his car in for a service, taking the opportunity to collect my new dress suit and to take back a pair of trousers for further alteration. He told her about his new cooker. "The doors will just about open, but are very stiff. How lovely about the azalea. You will be pleased." He inserted a drawing of a large-eyed seal in a frilled mob cap, bending solicitously over a pot plant on a small table, and ended, "I'll write again on Sunday. In the meantime, do please keep warm and dry." His stamina for chat and affectionate concern was inexhaustible. A larger opportunity for Larkin to make his mark on the culture of the age came the following January, when following Louis MacNeice's sudden death, Oxford University Press invited him to take over as editor of the new Oxford Book of Modern Verse. Larkin also continued to perform the tasks of a full-time university librarian, although stage two of the library rebuilding did not offer him the same satisfaction as stage one. Bryn Mawr Jones, the Vice-Chancellor, and Larkin were pioneers in creating the first new post-war British university library, and their professional relationship was good. However, they had little in common. Larkin wrote jocularly to Monica, "BJ's the man in charge. He shouldn't be at large. I'm butter, he's Marge." After Larkin's death, Sir Bryn Mawr said, "People who have written about him have made too much of his poems and not enough of him as librarian." The tension between his relationships with Monica and Maeve continued. In a letter to Monica of the 14th of September 1964, he represented his affair with Maeve as in its last throes. "We're quite friendly and have to see each other daily. The real breach and dismay is yet to come, I feel, and I suppose it will come." Monica did not believe him and felt deeply hurt. 1964 saw a definitive shift in Larkin's poetry as themes of aging and death come to the fore. On the 14th of July, he wrote glumly to the novelist Barbara Pym that poetry has deserted me. When it returned, it took a new form. He wrote in the centre of the first page of his seventh workbook, "Never write anything because you think it's true, only because you think it's beautiful." He was returning to his aesthetic roots. In his letters, he continued to declare his love for Monica and for Maeve with undiminished intensity. On the 4th of June 1966, he concluded a letter to Monica by squeezing, "Love, love, 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 love," into the right margin. 2 months later, however, he wrote playfully to May from Hayden Bridge, where he was staying with Monica, "You know, I'm never anything but happy to take you in my arms and enjoy that kind of kiss that seems to be your own speciality." Larkin had his own verdict on this love triangle. "There isn't any need to make my situation any better sounding than it is. A self-centered person conducting an affair containing almost no responsibilities with one girl, getting mixed up with another, heedless of the feelings of either. However, it is difficult to see how he could have broken the stalemate." Despite what he said, Monica's abject dependence imposed a crushing emotional responsibility upon him. Maeve was also, if to a lesser extent, dependent upon him, but gave his life a freshness and spontaneity lost in his relationship with Monica. Neither woman wanted to be free of him. Both knew they would find no other partner so attentive and life-enhancing. In 1966, Larkin wrote to Monica about Maeve, "You may wonder why I don't end it, in my own interests as well as yours. Partly cowardice, I dread the scene. Partly kindness. If I've encouraged her to depend on me, it seems cruel to turn her away." Kindness did indeed require him to continue both relationships. And kindness required also that he take all the blame upon himself. "It's my own unwillingness to give myself to anyone else that's at fault. Like promising to stand on one leg for the rest of one's life." Larkin told Robert Conquest, "Life is pretty grey up in Hull. Maeve wants to marry me. Monica wants to chuck me. I feel I want to become something other than a man. A rosebush, or some ivy, or something non-controversial." Regular short holidays with his mother in a spa hotel or seaside resort were followed or preceded by longer holidays with Monica. Maeve he would meet within the decorous context of the library and social events in Hull, or in brief snatch moments elsewhere. For several years in the 1960s, they visited Scarborough together on Christmas shopping trips to Roundtree's department store, taking lunch at the Pavilion Hotel. He pursued his own interests on trips to London, where he would visit Liberty's department store and share pornographic bookshop expeditions in Soho with Robert Conquest. He was working up to his limit, and living a full and, in his own terms, fulfilled life. In addition to day-to-day responsibility for the library, he was serving on national committees, writing literary reviews, composing a monthly jazz review for the Daily Telegraph, and producing a steady stream of correspondence, personal, professional, and literary. In informal contexts, he let off steam in ever more waspish aphorisms. In a letter to Kingsley Amis, he commented on Ted Hughes, "No, of course, Ted's no good at all. Not at all. Not a single solitary bit of good. I think his ex-wife, late wife, was extraordinary, though not necessarily likeable. Old Ted isn't even extraordinary." When Ray Brett of the Hull English Department remarked that the second volume of verse by an academic contemporary was at least up to the standard of the first, Larkin replied, "You can't fall off the floor." Increasingly, Larkin was looking backwards, regretting his lost youth, and disliking the overworked, overweight, older man he was becoming. He was aware of inexorable physical decline. He wrote to Monica, "Oh dear, I'm fat again. Needle well clear of 14 stone. Isn't it grim? I really must eat less, or something." To add to his sense of decline, his hearing was tested in 1967 and declared to be at the threshold of social adequacy. Over the following years, increasing deafness contributed to his isolation. His casual assumption that he would die at 63, the same age as his father, was hardening into a fixed prediction. On the 27th of March 1967, he wrote to Monica from Loughborough, lamenting that he was still tied to his mother. "I suppose I shall become free at 60, 3 years before cancer starts. What a bloody, sodding, awful life." Ever since 1961, Larkin had been writing his monthly jazz review in the Daily Telegraph. As the reviews proceeded, Larkin shows himself a partisan of traditional jazz. His earliest enthusiasm had been for the exuberant rhythms of black musicians. In January 1963, he wrote, Trad, everyone agrees, is dead, but it shows no more signs of lying down than modern does of sitting up. He seems deeply personally offended by John Coltrane. I do not remember ever suggesting that his music was anything but a pain between the ears. Some see this view as racist. But Louis Armstrong was also a black American, and Larkin's obituary of him stresses, "Armstrong was an artist of world stature, an American Negro slum child who spoke to the heart of Greenlander and Japanese alike." When the collected reviews, All What Jazz, was reissued in 1984, he reflected, "It now reads very anti-black, insofar as most of the people I bollock are black, Coltrane, Coleman, Shep. But then most of the people I praise are black too." He added with a twinkle, "Better play safe." The issue of Larkin's supposed racism only came to the fore after his death with the publication of his letters. The handful of racist comments, some of them indeed very unpleasant, are confined to private letters written to prejudiced correspondents. Monica Jones, for example, held right-wing views which Larkin did not share. But his self-irony escapes the notice of critics, as it no doubt escaped the notice of the original correspondents. In August, he snatched a week's holiday in Norwich with his mother, in marvellous weather, followed by a touring holiday in Ireland with Monica in his new car, an enormous 4-litre Vanden Plas Princess with a Rolls-Royce engine. It was love at first sight, he told Barbara Pym. By the beginning of the academic year in autumn 1969, Larkin already felt displaced within the university library. "There are so many new members of staff that I feel like a stranger in my own building." He was relying increasingly on Betty McAreth, who had now been his secretary for 12 years. As he told his mother, "If she doesn't do half of my work, she sort of chews it up to make it easier for me to swallow. I'd be lost without her." Increasingly deaf, overworked and alienated, Larkin was being pushed to the side of his own professional life. His response was to engineer an escape from Hull, if only a temporary one. He wrote to Barbara Pym, "I'm hoping to go to All Souls for 6 months in the autumn, a visiting fellow. My excuse is to finish off this wretched Oxford book, or let it finish me off." He spent the winter and spring terms of 1970-71 in Oxford. As his time there ran its course, Larkin became fatalistic and dispirited. "As I feared, I'm drawing English poetry in my own image, and it isn't going to make a good book." Nevertheless, his choices among his contemporaries and successors largely avoid contentiousness. "My taste," he bravely proclaimed, "is much more akin to that of the ordinary person than it is to that of the professional student or practitioner of literature." The Oxford Book of 20th Century English Verse was finally published in March 1973. Every reader encounters a quite different Larkin Oxford book, depending on which combination of its 207 poems he or she happens upon. But over time, it has performed its intended function of introducing readers to the variety of modern poetry as effectively as any conceivable alternative could have done.
Michael Pennington was reading from Philip Larkin, Life, Art and Love by James Booth. It's abridged by Libby Spurrier, produced by Joanna Green and is a peer production for BBC Radio 4. Well, in a couple of minutes in Woman's Hour, Sarah Waters will talk about her new novel, The Paying Guests, set in post-World War I London. Taking up the baton on behalf of female conductors will be Sian Edwards, and Seema Malhotra will discuss her new role as Shadow Minister for Preventing Violence Against Women and Girls, and will lay out the rug and have a picnic at Glyndebourne.
The lives, loves and tribulations of the local clergy and rural gentry.
The Reverend Mark Robarts and his wife are the nicest of Barsetshire people. They feel they've been blessed, and so they have. But, well, there's that invitation
to choose Chaldicotts above Framley Court. It doesn't belong at Chaldicotts.
BBC Radio 4's adaptation of Anthony Trollope's Barchester Chronicles, Framley Parsonage, starts on Sunday afternoon at 3 on BBC Radio 4.